This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud. Hey, I want to remind you that next week, Tuesday, August 4th, I'm going to be making my final appearance in New York City before I move to the West Coast. I'm teaching Anal Pleasure 101 at the Pleasure Chest at their Upper East Side location in New York City. I'm helping them celebrate and kick off Anal August. This event is free, so you may want to get there early for a place to sit / stand. And if you want to find out more information, go to pleasurechest.com. And then in September, I hope you're going to join me at CatalystCon West, September 11th to the 13th at the Los Angeles Marriott Burbank Airport Hotel. They just announced the opening keynote plenary is going to be Alex S. Morgan, Dr. Chris Donahue, Jenny Block, and Professor Mireille Miller-Young. The closing keynote afternoon tea is going to be Good Vibrations founder Joni Blank, interviewed by Lynn Camella. And of course, on the Thursday and Friday before the event begins, I'm doing two pre-con workshops, my Sex Educator Bootcamp 1 and 2. Find out more by going to catalystcon.com. Use the coupon code Tristan for $10 off your registration. Definitely check out my pre-con workshops. I'm really excited about them this year, and I can't wait to teach them, and I hope I see some of you very soon. So, I have this crazy, amazing panel of guests today, and what brings them all together is a book called The Best Sex Writing of the Year. And some of the promotional material says about this book, Surf the Sexual Zeitgeist with editor John Pressick, who has gathered the most important nonfiction on the topic of sex, ranging from discussions on consent and disability to the shocking response to the Steubenville rape case, to our insatiable love of sex toys, to BDSM and sobriety, and everything else in between. Today, we've got John coming to us from Canada in the woods, along with contributors Ashley Manta, who is in LA, Amy Dentata, who's in Sweden, and Molina Williams, who's on the phone. I think she's in New York. All of them are all over the place, but because of technology, we've brought them all together. They're each going to read their pieces from the book, and we're going to talk about each of their pieces, as well as the state of sex and sex writing today. So let me first tell you about John, who's like helming this whole situation. John Pressick is the editor of Cleus Press's book, Best Sex Writing of the Year. He is co-host and producer of the Toronto radio institution, Sex City, and the blogger behind Sex in Words. He's also a freelance editor and writer and co-columnist of Sex Stories We Love on Kinkley. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, John.
Hi, Tristan. How are you?
I'm really excited we're doing this. It's one of my favorite things I can do on radio is have people do this kind of reading that everyone can attend no matter where they are.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's really fun to do that. Getting out with this book and having some people come out and do the readings was amazing. Usually I'm behind a microphone, and getting out and chatting with people was great fun.
So how did you go about selecting all the pieces for this book? Because as I said in the opening, there's quite a diversity of topics and subjects.
It really is, and it was quite amazing that, some of it is because I'm constantly reading sex-related writing. It's part of my blog. It's part of the work I do with Kinkley. It's part of the radio show, Sex City. Like, I'm always consuming that sort of thing. So I have, you know, the people and the writers that I admire and enjoy and the pieces that I like. And then at the same time, when I was given this opportunity to create the book, to bring this anthology to a new level, I was amazed that, you know, I think I had 170 submissions to go through as well. So between my bank of stories that I'd already kind of bookmarked and kept on the blog, and then the submissions, it was going through and just looking at the massive diversity that is out there in the discussion of sex, which, if you think back not too long a time, discussions of sex were not diverse. They were not particularly wide-ranging. They were very narrow. But now we're open to discussing so many different topics.
Yeah. And do you think also the internet has changed that? I mean, there's just so many more venues, it seems to me, that people can talk about these issues, from alternative publications to more mainstream publications to their own blogs.
Well, exactly. And this is one big shift. Like, this, the Best Sex Writing Series, now we slightly changed the title for this volume, but the series itself has gone on for more than a decade, most years. But this particular collection is the first one that really, really embraces online writing. So a lot of the pieces come from blogs, a lot of the pieces come from websites, web magazines, things like that. There are still pieces from books, there are pieces from magazines, things like that as well, but so much of it did come from online content, and that's where I think you're really seeing the shift in sex writing from being something that was rarely discussed in mainstream media, and now mainstream is picking up on the success of sex writing online and starting to emulate that. So, you know, it always is the argument, well, online is just, you know, where, for lack of a better word, the crap goes. But no, it's where some amazing work is going, and now the mainstream is realizing that and realizing they should be tapping into that as well.
Yeah. Well, let's get right into it. I want to introduce our first contributor. Ashley Manta is a queer feminist sexuality educator, writer, and coach. She published her first ebook, A Feminist's Guide to Phone Sex, in 2014. Ashley speaks candidly about living with herpes and has done extensive work to promote acceptance and break the stigma surrounding sexually transmitted infections. She's the host of Carnal Copia, a sex and relationship podcast, and her latest project is Canasexual, which seeks to analyze the relationship between sex and cannabis. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Ashley.
Thank you so much for having me, Tristan.
I'm really excited that you're one of the people who's going to read your piece, because I think it's one of the really important ones. It's titled Growing Through the Yuck. And whenever you're ready, you can take it away.
Great. It's easy to get sucked into the negative when you're living with herpes. I remember the day that I was diagnosed. I was at the health center at my university, and I had the most horrific first herpes outbreak anyone could imagine. 2 solid weeks of not being able to sit, lie down, use the bathroom, or shower without excruciating pain. Not to mention the accompanying nausea, fatigue, and general feelings of misery. The nurse gave me the diagnosis, and I felt my heart hit the floor. Who would want me now since I have herpes? With shaking hands, I dialed my then-boyfriend's cell phone number, The rash I have, it's herpes, I said, cringing with every word. I had a feeling that's what it was, he replied calmly. Are you mad? I asked. No, sweetie, he said. You're still the same person you were an hour ago. It's just herpes. It's not life-threatening. I was shocked. I was expecting anger, even fury. I spread herpes to him unknowingly because I didn't recognize the symptoms, and here he was reassuring me. Together, we researched home remedies and information on herpes that was now a part of both of our lives. We supported each other through our first outbreak and subsequent outbreaks until we finally went our separate ways a few months later. It was wonderful to have someone who understood what I was going through. It was even more incredible to have a partner who cared about me and supported me through a period of pretty intense anger and self-loathing. I felt dirty. I felt unlovable. I felt unattractive. He helped me get through those feelings, at least temporarily. It wasn't until I attempted to get back into the dating scene that I realized that not everyone was so understanding. I was rejected countless times. It got to the point that I started disclosing on the first date just to get it over with. My reasoning was, at least if and when he rejected me, we would have only wasted one date. All those feelings of inadequacy, self-loathing, and depression came flooding back. I became convinced that I was never going to find someone who would want to deal with my condition. I felt myself descending into what I have now termed the yuck. The yuck is a place of toxic feelings. It harbors the helpless victim mentality and feeds into feelings of anger, resentment, blame, and sorrow. It is easy to get trapped in the yuck. It's like quicksand. One minute, you're doing okay, and then as soon as you have a bad date, an outbreak, or even hear a herpes joke, you're right back down in the pit of despair. I felt broken, worthless, and alone. Gradually, I started to learn more about herpes. I learned about herpes transmission rates and ways to keep outbreaks under control. I learned that there was herpes dating sites and herpes support groups. I found a therapist and did some hard work with her, including letting go of my anger at the guy who raped me, which is how I ended up with herpes. I started to grow. I decided that I needed something to represent my new outlook on life. I'm a firm believer in body reclamation, and for me, that sometimes takes the form of tattoos. Halloween 2009, 3 months after the rape that caused the herpes and 1 month after my herpes diagnosis, I decided to go get a lotus tattoo on my right shoulder. The lotus flower grows in the mud in shallow water and does not bloom until it reaches the surface. While it's growing, the flower petals are safe inside the blossom, which keeps them from getting stained by the mud. I always loved the symbolism of the lotus flower, but didn't realize how accurate the metaphor was for me until about 2 years later. I battled my anger, my resentment, and my self-consciousness many times over those 2 years. Underneath the lotus is a Tibetan Buddhist mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. This mantra is a devotion to Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. It serves as a daily reminder that I cannot know where someone else has been or what led them to this point. It encourages me to show compassion to others as well as myself. Healing is not a linear path. There are twists and turns, forks and loops. It took a lot of tears, many sleepless nights, and a lot of support to get me to where I am now. Thanks to my friend Adriel and his wonderful website, The Herpes Opportunity, I found the strength to come out about having herpes. I told my friends, family, and the internet. I have to say, I've never felt so free in my entire life. It feels wonderful to be able to speak openly about having herpes, instead of saying the word in hushed tones while constantly looking over my shoulder, wondering who might be listening and judging. I feel genuine and authentic, which is a huge improvement over the way I felt when I was still in the yuck. I encourage everyone to take time to reflect on where they are in the growth process. Are you still in the yuck? Don't worry, there are others there too, and you can help each other grow. Are you growing, but not quite at the surface? Reach out and help, and let people help you. And to those who have blossomed, share your beauty with the world. Don't be afraid of your roots. Remember them, because they are a testament to your strength and perseverance throughout this journey.
Thank you, Ashley. I love that piece. I really do. Because you confront this stigma with such a sort of clear-headedness. But for you, that took a little bit of time and a lot of processing, it sounds like.
It took so much time and processing. I mean, even now, I still struggle with it sometimes.
You do?
Sure.
Why do you think there is still so much stigma attached to herpes?
I think a lot of it has to do with the lack of information that's out there. People don't understand that herpes is not really that big of a deal. You know, my friend Adriel calls it acne genitalis. And it's also the transmission rates are so low. The ways in which it's transmitted are so specific. Like, if someone kisses me, they're not going to get herpes because I have genital herpes. But I've had people be like, oh my gosh, am I going to get cold sores since I kissed you? And like that kind of misinformation, I think, leads to the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is one of the pieces that, like, Ashley and I had connected online before I even got the gig for the book. But like, this is one of the pieces that I think is the internet being so important in helping get this information out to people. And misinformation and dealing with misinformation and hopefully getting rid of misinformation. And when I received this one, I was just like, yes, boom, this is right in the list.
Oh, thank you, John.
And it strikes me also, I kind of love this conversation where you call your then boyfriend and say, I have herpes. And his reaction is pretty priceless. I mean, do you think that helped you in kind of moving through it, that the first person you told didn't shame you?
Yes, that was huge. Like, I have such respect for him for the way that he handled that disclosure that, like, I can't even say enough good things about him.
I mean, but it also kind of presents a model for other people, right? To be on the receiving end of that call, perhaps.
Absolutely. Like, it's so important to react calmly and with compassion and not just knee-jerk, ew, gross, disgusting, like all of the things that you've been sort of culturally that you've been culturally taught to feel about herpes. Like, there's so much disgust around it and so many jokes, and that gets into our psyche. So to have someone model this really permissive, understanding reaction was really important.
Yeah. And the statistics, I mean, of how many people have herpes chances are you are going to come across someone, whether they're a friend or a lover or a partner, right?
Absolutely. In fact, most people who have herpes don't even know they have it because they're asymptomatic, but they can still spread it through viral shedding.
Mm. And you talked about home remedies in your piece. Are you on medication or do you just do home remedies?
I am on medication because I'm polyamorous, because I have a lot of sex. For me, it's really comforting to be able to tell my prospective partners, like, I take daily suppressive medication that's really good for keeping the herpes dormant. Mm-hmm. But I also use tea tree oil when I'm having an outbreak that helps to dry out the sores. And I recently discovered a new remedy that I had never heard of before. I use Foria, the THC-infused coconut oil lube. And I thought, you know, just for giggles, I would see if it would be helpful, because I know coconut oil is good for you. I know THC oil has healing properties. And so I sprayed some on during my last outbreak, and I actually found my discomfort lessened and the outbreak was not as long as it normally is.
Wow. Okay, I haven't even, then that kind of overlaps with all your other work too that you're doing right now around cannabis and pot and being sexual.
Definitely.
Okay, so we've got to take a commercial break, but I want people to know that Ashley's going to stick around for more talk. If you want to find her right now, this very second, you can go to ashleymanta.com. She's also on Twitter at Ashley Manta, Instagram at Sex Ed with Ashley, and Facebook Sex and Sweet Things. So coming up next, we're going to hear from contributor Amy Dentata, who talks about how a porn movie changed her sex life. Stay with us. More Sex Out Loud when we return.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
Up Close with Chris Tinney is now on Voice America Variety. Every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, Chris brings you the thought leaders, activists, and socially responsible entrepreneurs taking action for the environment, doing business in a new way, and helping the underprivileged. Call in or listen in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, and learn how the small decisions you make today have a big impact on our small planet in the future. Tune in to Up Close with Chris Tinney on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at PuckerUp.com. That's Tristan at PuckerUp.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. I'm talking today with and featuring the work of the contributors to Best Sex Writing of the Year, edited by John Pressick. And our next contributor is Amy Dentata, a writer, game designer, artist, and performer who touches on topics including trauma recovery, mental illness, sexuality, futurism, and transgender issues. She started performing music at open mics in her hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, before moving to the Bay to pursue a career as a game artist. While attending school in San Francisco, she simultaneously discovered the SF Queer open mic and a love for spoken word. And she's going to read a piece from the book called Fumbling Towards Humanity, How Trans Girls Helped Me Open Up to My Partner. Hi, welcome to Sex Out Loud, Amy.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I really love your piece. I want to get right to it.
All right. I was single by choice for years before I felt the dating itch again. I took to OkCupid, and on the rare occasion someone actually responded, met with the stranger. Without fail, we would realize we lacked chemistry and never see each other again. After each dating failure, I felt a mixture of sadness and relief. A failed date meant I didn't have to worry about physical intimacy. It meant I didn't have to worry about taking my clothes off in front of another person. It meant I didn't have to face the chance of, at best, another teachable moment regarding transphobia, or at worst, mortal danger. I lose no matter what. Giving cis partners the trans 101 talk is exhausting. When dating other trans people, I still feel gross because of my body. I'm pre-op and very uncomfortable about my genitalia. It's hard for me to get off even just masturbating. I have to cover myself in blankets and touch myself just right so my anatomy feels like it's configured the right way. Sometimes I'm okay using my current equipment, but even then, it feels weird. It's just weird in a way I can enjoy. At least when masturbation does work, I know exactly what buttons to push. I know just the right way to jiggle the door handle, the right twist to turn on the faucet. Teaching that to someone else takes time. It requires a partner who's willing to listen and who can handle freakouts when my body upsets me. The stars have to align just right to find a partner like that. Dating is a crapshoot for anybody, but for me, the odds are stacked even higher. The stars did align recently, though. I'm seeing someone new, a wonderful cisgender girl I'll call Kate. In Kate, I found a partner who not only thinks I'm sexy, but understands my body issues and is willing to learn all the quirks involved in getting me off. Our first physical exploration involved cuddling. Cuddling is amazing with her. It usually takes a long time for me to warm up, but with her, I get turned on almost immediately. Once I try to move beyond cuddling, however, I freeze up. My first time with her, I was reluctant to take off my clothes. I was scared of rejection and felt mortified about my body. I also felt alone, profoundly alone, in a way that's hard to describe. Cisgender people have representation everywhere in the media. Images of them dating, making out, getting dirty and getting dirty are on TV, in movies, books, commercials, billboards, just about everywhere. Mainstream representation of women like me, on the other hand, is rare and usually follows the predictable script. Cis man unwittingly goes out with a trans woman. Cis man finds out she's trans, always in the form of a joke at the woman's expense. Cisgender man vomits and or kills her. There's no romance for trans women in the media, unless the plot involves a tragic ending. We are either a punchline or a very special episode of Blossom. We can't just fall in love, get in normal fights, have hot makeup sex, or any other romantic activity cis people take for granted. In mainstream porn, we are made into fantasy creatures that exist only to fulfill the taboo fantasies of cisgender straight men. There aren't any widely known cultural stories and dating norms that include trans women. We are always on the frontier, and while that can feel exhilarating, it's also alienating. The first time Kate and I had sex, I was too nervous to orgasm. It wasn't for lack of support either. She was a caring, listening lover. She eagerly learned the ways I like being touched and what to avoid so I don't get dysphoric. Our second time together, as I reached the same impassable plateau, I asked her to stop and lay there crying. Dysphoria and anti-trans baggage won out. I felt disgusting. She wished she could do something to help. We sat on the bed and chatted for a while. To pass the time, I showed her my strap-on harness and my porn DVDs. Trans girls, in particular, caught her eye. As the night ended, she reassured me, "You don't have to apologize. For anything, for my body issues, for crying, for feeling insecure." Kate and I fell headfirst into the infatuation phase of our relationship. The next day, during work, she told me over Facebook that she was reading through my blog because she just couldn't get enough of me. That scared me, because I've written a lot about my dating frustrations as a trans woman and the ways cis people have hurt me. Would she get offended by me talking about cis people in a negative light? Would she think I'm too angry? I was convinced she would find a reason somewhere in my blog to hate me. But she still made plans for our next date. This time, I was sleeping over. At her place, we cuddled and immediately got turned on, like our previous times together. It was our third time together in the sheets, and my anxiety levels were increasing with each encounter. Surely, that night, my transness would ruin everything. I was too broken and strange for anyone to love. "You wanted to watch one of my DVDs, right?" I asked. I'd bought several, but out came Trans Girls, the subject on the tip of both of our tongues. We lay together, bodies wrapped around each other, and watched the opening scene with Chelsea Poe and Maxine Holloway. "That place looks familiar," she said. They filmed the opening part at the Dyke March last year. We both lamented having missed the march. "It's so hot that they're actually doing it right there in public," she said. I agreed, mostly by moaning, because at that point her hands were traveling all over me. Then the scene cut to an apartment, and Chelsea and Maxine tore off each other's clothes. There on the screen was someone like me, having sex with someone like Kate. They were both happy, enthusiastic, and into each other. No surprise reveal, no horrified reaction shots, no cis gaze ruminating on how a trans partner might affect a cis person's feelings about their sexual orientation. Just two women fucking. It made me feel human and naked, even though my clothes were already off. A layer of psychic armor, hardened by slurs, stereotypes, and violence, melted off my body. It felt like the universe said to me, "We have a place for you. You belong here." I said to Kate, "In a little bit, you're going to find out something I love about Maxine." Maxine Holloway laughs when she comes, and it is so adorable. Kate agreed. Sometime after the second scene of the film, I had an amazing orgasm, all thanks to Kate. The isolation I felt during our previous encounters washed away. That orgasm was a revelation, a moment of healing. And I laughed like Maxine through the intense torrent of emotions. That was the first time I'd ever laughed while coming, instead of crying. I regret to say I had a hard time paying attention to the rest of the film. By the end of the night, I was completely exhausted in the best way possible. I didn't think the evening would end with me lying in bed with her, catching my breath, but there we were. "I read in your blog that cis women scare you," she said. Uh-oh. The exact words in my blog were, "Cis women scare the shit out of me. Their bodies make me feel inferior, masculine, fake. Their mere presence can feel like it's erasing my identity." "Yeah," I said, hiding my face in her boobs like I'd suddenly forgotten object permanence. She asked, "Does that mean I scare you too?" Sometimes, I said. I didn't want to say it, but I wasn't going to lie. She was supposed to get offended, supposed to say, "We're not all like that, you know," supposed to dismiss my problems as whiny hypersensitivity, like countless other people before her. Instead, she cooed and petted my hair. She said that hopefully she can be less scary. She kept holding me. She wouldn't let go, and I didn't want her to. I belonged there.
Thanks for that, Amy. This piece is so raw and vulnerable. Was there ever a point when you wrote it and thought, oh my God, I can't put this out in the world?
No, but that was mostly because I wrote it and then published it before I had a chance to think that. I didn't give
sometimes
myself,
the best way.
I mean, it is, but yeah. Yes.
It just, I don't know, it felt really profound and important, and I was like, I have to put this out there, and I did, and I'm very glad that I did.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like it, first of all, I feel like it can speak to everyone, not just trans people. Anyone who's ever had any kind of body dysmorphia or even just body feelings about their body and being with a partner sexually. So it has this universal quality, but I also think it speaks to this kind of nitty gritty of sex that we often don't hear about from trans women.
Yeah, like what do you mean in particular?
Well, I feel like because trans women are often over-sexualized or de-sexualized, the first thing that they don't want to talk about sex as like the opening, you know, thing about their lives, right?
Yeah.
And so, and I understand why, but then that also leaves this kind of blank space. And I feel like this really delves into a topic that helps those of us who aren't trans really get a grip on, especially if we're going to be partnered with someone who's trans.
Yeah, yeah, it can be hard to write about that stuff and to write about it matter-of-factly and just honestly, because there's so much pressure in several different ways that are really unhealthy. And I think it just takes, I don't know, I think part of the reason I was able to write this the way that I did is just because I've done so much previous work in writing, trying to articulate things, trying to articulate sexuality and trying to describe my experiences as a trans woman. And I had to fight through all of these layers of existing, like really messed up terminology and stereotypes, because we get taught those stereotypes too. And it takes a while to unlearn that and to speak to your actual experience.
And John, what about this spoke to you that you said, oh my God, I have to have this for the book?
Well, it was two things. I mean, this is one that came in, Amy's, yours came in as a submission, so I wasn't familiar with your work, which was exciting. I loved reading the new submissions. But it was the two things. It was one is the, exactly like you said, Tristan, the vulnerability and the personal. And these are the pieces that, you know, you're seeing online. And people are really open and write and able to write about themselves in ways that traditional media is not going to accept, unless you somehow, you know, manage to swing your book deal and get your memoirs published. But online work and blogs and things and this type of writing and Amy's piece, those were the pieces that I think are so advancing our discussions of sex and sexuality and identity and everything like that. And the fact that it was, I mean, I've seen pieces like this that relate to different identities, but I think that we're really seeing the understanding and need to see more work by trans writers who are talking about their own experiences, their own stories. We can think of stories and write about trans people, but I mean, personally, I like to read from people directly. And that's where I just, you know, I read this and just went, wow. And I really want, I really want this here.
And what kind of response have you gotten, Amy?
It's been very, very positive, and I've been kind of blown away. One of my most talked about articles involves my girlfriend, and she's like, "Oh my God, we like just started dating," and then boom, this explodes.
Wait, and are you still girlfriends?
Oh, yeah, we're totally still dating. She's awesome. And we're still head over heels. We're still in the infatuation phase, to be honest. And she's just been, she's like kind of proud to be a part of that, you know, to be a part of being able to get this kind of story out there.
Yeah. But I love that. I love that story, and I love that you're still with her. Okay, we got to take a break. Coming up next, we're going to hear from someone you've heard on the show before. She's one of my favorite guests, and, you know, according to statistics, yours too. Melina Williams is going to join us and read her piece from this book. So stay with us.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
On the morning of August 5th, 1962, the world awoke to the shocking news that Marilyn Monroe, one of the biggest icons in Hollywood history, had been found dead. What really happened that night? Join Nina Bosky as she seeks to uncover both the life and tragic death of Marilyn Monroe and what keeps her so popular over 50 years later. Good Night Marilyn Radio, live every Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. We are hearing some of the really dynamic, diverse contributions to the book Best Sex Writing of the Year, edited by John Pressick. And you're going to recognize this next person's voice because she's been on Sex Out Loud a few times. She's a repeat offender. Melina Williams is an award-winning, critically acclaimed writer, actress, BDSM educator, and storyteller. She's the author of The Toy Bag Guide to Taboo Play and co-author of Playing Well with Others, Your Guide to Discovering, Exploring, and Navigating the Kink, Leather, and BDSM Communities. Without further ado, Melina, take it away.
All right, I'm reading my piece from Best Sex Writing of the Year, which is called Tell Me You Want Me. As someone who is submissive, not only in terms of power exchange relationships, but also quite sexually submissive, I field a lot of questions about what that means. So, do you just, like, lie there? You don't care what happens to you in bed? Will you just do whatever they tell you? I assume you have to be spineless to be a sub. Awesome. I command you to suck my dick. Well, okay, no, no, maybe, hell no, and after you suck mine. One of the things that gets me going on rants is the assumption that so many people make that submission is tantamount to cowering in corners, waiting to be used and abused. There is an insane amount of energy, drive, will, and desire that it takes to submit successfully. And by successfully, I mean to the mutual satisfaction of all involved. Because yes, submissives and slaves, need to turn the page, sorry, hold on, let me take this back and do this again, okay. Because yes, submissives and slaves and bottoms need to have their needs met too. And for some of us, one of the hottest ways we have our needs met is by providing pleasure to others, facilitating ease in their lives. The first connection I made with how aroused I became as a result of serving someone else was an interesting byproduct of a rather passionate affair I had many years ago. Interestingly, after a rather earth-shattering first meeting with a man who had a certain something, wound up disabling my not insubstantial defenses, and after a exhilarating, dangerous, edgy, deeply erotically brutal encounter, I had an unsettling epiphany. All I wanted to do was to keep him happy. Bring him coffee, get his dry cleaning, buy his cigarettes, after taking note of what brand he smoked, of course, draw his bath, find a restaurant I thought he would enjoy, anything to have him pleased with the job I'd done. And the more I did for him, the more irresistible he found me, and the dynamic fed on itself like a sexual weather system that exploded into gorgeous thunderstorms of intense passion and lustful liaisons. And when he told me how hard he got, how much he wanted to fuck me, and exactly how he was going to do it, and he assured me that I was the cause of all the delicious torments that were about to be inflicted upon my quivering, sweaty, willing flesh, well. This initial experience was enough to turn my head towards a path of submission and service that I continue to walk to this day. When I was first exploring my submissive self, I assumed that deducing and doing whatever the dominant wanted me to do would be fulfilling enough, and I would be pleased by that and that alone. This is an ideal that some people hold holy, the selfless slave, the doting submissive, who only needs the sustenance of knowing they did a good job in order to be satisfied. That affection, feedback, love, and attention from the dominant is a gift that may be given at the whim of the dominant, and that submissives and slaves are not entitled to those bits of emotional nourishment. I have learned the hard way that a diet of emotional crumbs leads to spiritual starvation. There are absolutely things that I need as a submissive, as a slave, as a human in bondage to thrive in my desired role. And that is part of what makes me who I am. It is not just me putting everything I am on the table that makes these connections erotic and beautiful and edgy and vital. So, what about submitting? What about service? What about taking a thorough flogging? What about menial chores? What about being useful? Is sexy? Why is it eroticized? What makes it hot? In a word, passion. The first time I looked into the eyes of someone who was using me with a seeming disregard for my own satisfaction, when I saw the heat and the fire in the eyes of my lover as they took what they wanted from me and effortlessly bent me to their will, when I saw how ferociously and almost dangerously aroused they became, that passion pulled me abruptly from the realm of what I had known about sex into a new place. I was rather shocked to experience the oxymoron of feeling closer to the person who was causing me erotic, intense pain than I had to previous lovers who had been gentle and circumspect in their lovemaking. This realization that the brutal edge of passion was intensely erotic and profoundly compelling to me drove me to question many things. My sanity, first, but then what the root of that desire was, and then to question how I could have more and more of that energy in my life. As I became involved in the leather, kink, and BDSM communities, I realized that passion came in so many more flavors than I ever could have imagined. The first time I was to do a rope bondage scene, I thought it would be quite tedious. It was anything but. I wrote a bit about my love for rope and how it evolved, and certainly the intense desire that my partner had to see me bound and helpless fueled my own passion. I've had other play partners for whom a very different type of play ignites their own fires, and I have discovered that, for me, asking a new play partner, "Where do you want to go today?" is the best way for me to serve them and, in turn, serve myself. It can seem a very evasive technique to answer a query of, what do you want to do with, well, tell me what you find hot. What draws you in? What is it that made you decide to jump into this dark world? But in fact, I learned so much. the dominant whose eyes light up as they talk about scenes where their partner is squirming in embarrassment, or the top who eagerly shows off an impressive collection of canes, or the switch who loves nothing more than pony play because they know what it's like from both sides of the bridle, or the master who's dedicated to their path of mastery and who seeks their partner, their counterpart, in whom they will manifest themselves and invest their love and their time and their energy. All of these people are now engaging in foreplay with me. Yep, foreplay, because I am certainly turned the hell on by listening to what turns other people on. And if I'm interested in playing with you, I certainly need to know what pleases you the most, what gets you hot the fastest, what you think about when making yourself come over and over and over in the dead of night when you are playing the film of your darkest, dirtiest, hottest fantasies in the private theater of your own mind. The passion doesn't even have to be for a specific type of play in order to get me hot. Someone keenly attracted to me is more likely to pique my interest than someone who doesn't demonstrate an intense desire to get into my pants. If I am interacting with someone and I don't feel a particular spark, I can promise you that I will take a second look at that person if they manage to frankly express a sincere expression of the fact that they find me desirable. The people I recall with the most passion, and when I say recall, I mean masturbate furiously while recalling, those are the people who are the most flagrant in their lasciviousness. From the ex-boyfriend who reveled in my fat belly and became immediately hard when I took off my shirt, to the lover who agonized for several long moments trying to decide to come in my cunt or in my mouth. "Both are so sweet, baby, I just can't decide," he whispered. Their expressions of lust for me were hypnotic and irresistible. Passionate lust is sexy as hell. Wanting me, wanting to do bad things to me and telling me so, wanting to possess me, to use me, consume me with ferocity and delight is an aphrodisiac like no other. Desire is sexy. Lust is hot. Once I know what you crave the most, when you tell me that you want me and I have absorbed some of your joy and delight in these things, in me, I have a handle on what to do that will turn you on the most. I can be aware, open, present, aroused, and raring to go and do whatever it takes to bring your fantasy to form. And I know this is true for people all over the spectrum of kink. Dominant, submissive, switch, top, bottom, or just a kinky motherfucker. We all love feeling desirable, feeling wanted, feeling like the center of the universe for our partner. Regardless if it is just for a few fleeting hours of play, a quickie in a borrowed bed, or a lifetime committed relationship. Bringing the rawness of passion to the fore can move a quotidian encounter into the realm of a heroic hedonism that will leave an impression that will not soon fade.
Molina once again has dropped the mic. That's all she does. She comes on my show and she just fucking drops the mic. My God. Talk about hypnotic. Wow. I mean, I think what's so compelling about your piece, Molina, is that it's from the heart. You know, it's from the heart. And how can you not respond when someone kind of lays themselves bare in the way that you do?
You know, it's interesting because there are people who don't. And I have learned over the years to see how easy it is for folks who are users of other people to absorb you without giving anything back. And one of the things that I do, because I'm, you know, risky like that, is I do pour myself out. Now, I learned very quickly how to recognize when I wasn't getting that back, which is what motivated writing this piece, is that I realized that I had situations where I had poured myself out and gotten a response that really should have indicated to me, this person's not on the same page that you are. But you go for it anyway because you're so lonely or so desperate or so needing to have that dynamic exist. And then you realize that, yeah, you are snacking on the tiniest little bits of sustenance, and that's not something you can sustain. And so one of the things I did in writing this was to say, you know what? Here are the things that worked. Here's how someone else's passion for me helped me to know that this was where I needed to be. And the underlying message being, everyone deserves this. We all deserve to have that level of connection and passion if we want it and if we need it.
Gosh, unfortunately, we are out of time. Man, I want everyone to, I want to know that Melina is Melina everywhere. And by that, I mean on FetLife, on Twitter, and she's even Melina.com. And I also forgot to tell people that Amy Dentata is Amy Dentata everywhere on Twitter and AmyDentata.com. And I want to thank Ashley. I want to thank Amy. I want to thank Melina. I want to thank John Presick, who's the editor of this incredible collection, for doing this show. And
thanks, John Presick.
God, sharing the stories.
Thanks, John.
I just think this this book really pulls together writing that is seemingly on such different topics, and yet there are these threads that run throughout the pieces you heard today and in the rest of the book around vulnerability, around tackling taboos, around speaking the unspeakable, and around activism, writing as sex activism. So you should all pick up this book, Best Sex Writing of the Year by editor John Presick, and it's from Cleus Press. You can find out more at bestsexwritingoftheyear.com, and you can also follow this book and its travels and its adventures at Best Sex Writers on Twitter. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, associate producer Raymond Johnson, segment producer and editor Colton, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, Matt, my engineer, and Michael on the board today, and everyone at Voice America. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, when my guest will be Tina Horn, talking about her new book, Love Not Given Lightly, Profiles from the Edge of Sex. Until then, find us on Facebook, on Twitter, at Sex Out Loud Radio. Go read this book and start talking about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.